From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Early in May, some 60,000 people converged on Las Vegas. All of them came there because of the Internet, the global communications network. The Internet started out some 20 years ago as the ARPANET, a federal government project designed to build a data communications network which could move data throughout the world and which could not be brought down. Today, some 30 million people are linked worldwide, and its latest feature, Mosaic, lets you send, receive, and view any video picture. We used the opportunity of the NetWorld plus Interop conference to talk to some of the people involved. Dan Lynch, founder of the Interop conference, Carl Malamud, president of the Internet Multicasting Service, John Gage, chief scientist of Sun Microsystems, Jack Haverty of Oracle Corporation, and Michael Howard, president of Infinetix Research. Well, gentlemen, welcome to our program today.
Thank you.
Now, Carl, you're a busy guy, so we're going to get to you first here.
Get rid of me first, huh?
get you on, get you off. That's an old radio trick. But tell us, describe to everybody, what is the Internet Showcase and what you're doing here this week?
Well, for marketing purposes, we're calling this a cyber station. What it basically means is we're putting programming out over the global Internet computer network. It's multi-protocol, it's multimedia. Multi-protocol means it's everything from electronic mail, simple messages, to real-time broadcasts. Multimedia means it's different kinds of data. It's audio data, it's visual data, images, and full motion video. And it's plain old text, it's links. What we're trying to do is take advantage of the full purpose of a general purpose infrastructure like the Internet.
Now you're going out over the Internet, but you're also broadcasting here, right? I mean, people can pick you up here at the show.
Well, they're part of the Internet, right? The Internet network includes 40,000 networks all over the world, and for an Interop week, at NetWorld plus Interop, we add another 8,000 computers.
And
in fact,
at the show.
Absolutely, and in fact, Interop owns a Class A address, I believe, one of the few Class A addresses in the world remaining.
That's Class A, not Classy, right there.
Right. That's not Bay Class A, right?
That's right. How many of the booths here do you think have actually brought this in? Do we know?
Have actually talked to our data, as
yeah.
opposed to going back to their home network
exactly.
and logging in and things like that. We're not quite sure, which is one of the interesting things. It'd be like asking you how many people listen to your show. You can make a wild guess, and we'd
or
be happy to make our own wild guess.
Yeah,
well, but they're making a wild guess.
Well,
they're making
right?
a calculated guess.
They're making
guess.
A statistically calculated guess. Now.
Well, our estimates are during the course of our normal processing that we reach about 100,000 people in 30 countries. And I like to say that estimate is at least as accurate as a Nielsen.
Right. What I was wondering about was if we're going to try to do something, say, after the Internet, send out some email or saying, did you, how long, or are we going to try to track the coverage of this afterward?
Yeah, we've been gathering extensive statistics, and Jeffrey Schiller from MIT Network Computing has acted as our traffic reporter, and he's been looking at it. One thing we do know, we are the vast majority of the data going out to the Internet from the Interop show floor. There's a lot of people reading electronic mail, a lot of people doing things, but when you look at the total volume of bits, I'm afraid we've taken more than our fair share.
Now, just for everybody who is listening but doesn't really know it, how many hours of programming have you put on during this show?
Approximately 40 hours in 3 days.
Carl, thank you very much. I know
you're
real busy here, and thank you for hosting us this week. Now, Dan, I want to first turn to you. You founded Interop, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I remember talking to you, it was possibly a year ago, where you said, how many people were at the first Interop conference?
300.
300. And you basically said, these were 300 of like my closest friends. Like, I knew all these people. So now you have 100,000 of your closest friends, something like that.
Well, and Jack, right out there, okay. he was there at the beginning, so Jack Haverty from Oracle.
That's 100,000
and one.
100,001 closest friends. What is it like for you now? What has been your experience with this Interop? What did you do?
Well, I obviously found something that people wanted.
Yeah.
I couldn't force this many people to like this technology. It must have been something that they were waiting for. And I knew that, or I felt that. Jack and I and many others who were in the R&D world in the 70s worked on this early technology of connecting all the computers together so that they could people could do anything they wanted amongst all of the different computers all over the planet. And we did it in a laboratory environment. It was very expensive per computer in those days. And we noticed that people liked it. They liked the ability to share their information with anyone else that with whom they choose to share it. And then it was just a matter of getting it out to the world, commercializing it, whatever you want to call that. And in the beginning, trying to get it commercial, the U.S. government did something in the usual U.S. government way. They ordered manufacturers to make their computers talk this way. And after ordering them to
do that,
and then after ordering them to do that, they didn't tell them how to do it. And I said, well, that's your responsibility to figure out how, you know. I mean, we place purchase orders, right? And I said, gee, maybe I could help these vendors actually figure out how to serve the government, you know, because I knew how the stuff worked, but more importantly, I knew all the people who really knew how it worked, okay? And I asked them if they would come and give lectures to all the vendors about how to make this really work. And they agreed to do so. And the rest is history, as they say.
Now, the first one, you were obviously running around and hanging banners and ordering signs and all that stuff. What's the truth? What do you do now? What's your role now?
No, wait a minute.
Come on, Dan.
There was an intervening
Just
time
me.
When I worked.
Yes, you once worked. It was reported. I've heard rumors.
I mean, in the very beginning, I mean, as I said, I...
You did everything.
I had a few people that helped me do everything, and I hired, you know, a PR person and a conference organizer and people who knew what they were doing, you know, in the delivery of information, right? And then after a few years, when it became obvious that we wanted to have a trade show associated with it, with all these computers, you know, walking their talk, as they say, or talking their walk, or whatever it is.
Whatever they say.
Yeah.
Proving that it works.
Proving that it works, that I needed to hire new people who knew how to actually put on a trade show.
Right? A real one, yeah.
A real one, because I certainly didn't know. I knew as an attendee, but I didn't know how to do it. So, you know, all my life I've just basically been collecting people who are, you know, better at something than I am.
You and keep saying at every step, well, I didn't know how to do this, so I had to find somebody else who did it.
Yeah. Well, I
what do you know how to do, Dan?
Well, I was the dumbest guy they could find who was smart enough to do this job.
Okay. You didn't have anything to do, so you could collect them, huh?
That's right, okay. And now, you know, I'm the Jack describes me as the Pied Piper or something like that of the internet. And I just really want people to understand what a beautiful technology this is to unify mankind. And I just spread it any way I can.
Now, when you come to this conference, I mean, I can imagine that they have a schedule for you every day. First, you got to be here, they got to be over here.
Oh, yeah.
Are you mostly now talking?
Yes, I'm a talker. And I no longer am a day-to-day manager of this enterprise at all. My job is to promote it, to explain it to people, expand it into new markets. Right now, this year, we're going to have it in 5 locations, in Tokyo, and Berlin, and Paris, and Atlanta, and here in Las Vegas. This is the first one of the year. And I started working on those new venues, you know, a number of years ago, and they're coming to fruition now. And I'm out looking at, you know, other things around the world to spread this idea and this, you know, technology and markets and products around the world.
Will this be the biggest show or no?
What, this one here?
Yeah.
Oh, you betcha.
This is that's we've seen an international presence here for sure.
Yeah.
But the other shows will be smaller.
I think the Atlanta show will be about the same size as this one, actually.
Uh-huh.
And I refuse to guess about Tokyo. Because they're...
Is that your first one there?
It's our first show in Tokyo, and there are 25 million people, you know, within an hour's ride of the convention center, and they're very interested in all this technology. So I have no idea what's going to happen in Tokyo.
One quick question here, Dan. Is Interop ever going to become a consumer show? Do you see that?
Yes.
How soon?
5 years. 5 years.
So we'll have to find a whole new city to take over?
Yike.
He's going to reach.
No, then you do
He's
it.
He's going to
no,
reach in the home.
Then you have it in 75 locations.
Yeah.
See, right now it's concentrated for
the
insiders.
So I may never see you again.
You'll
sure.
see them all over
That's
the world.
Right. Yeah, in Phoenix.
That's
okay,
right. Okay. We'll go play golf. That's
You'll
good.
Meet on the superhighway.
You're listening to Tech Nation Live from Las Vegas, Nevada, and the 1994 NetWorld plus Interrupt Conference. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Michael Howard, president of Infinetics Research, Dan Lynch, founder of Interrupt, John Grage, director of science for Sun Microsystems, and we've already heard from Carl Malamud, president of Internet Multicasting Service. Now, Michael, I want to turn to you and have you tell everybody, what is Infinetics Research?
Infinetics Research is a small, independent market technology firm that gives advice to networking vendors. We talk to end users, the people that buy networking products. We spend several hundred hours a year talking to them. We also spend, seems like, hundreds of hours talking to the network vendors as well. And so we have a view of the marketplace that looks at both the supply side and the demand side.
So you're providing sort of marketing data?
Some of it's data, but it more amounts to what products vendors should bet on, what features, what technologies, how end users view networking products, what they want next, uh-huh. how they choose products, how they choose networking vendors.
So you're a sort of consultant to a group of these people?
To Infinetics. All of the networking vendors.
All of the networking
right.
vendors. Do you have a booth here?
No.
Oh,
we had back-to-back appointments with people in booths and hotel rooms.
I've heard about this.
Yeah, no. Maybe I should charge
Dan,
you.
Yeah, you are making
a new
really,
opportunity here.
Yeah, that's right. Dan's learning something. Well, you know, I think that's an interesting question. Having been to many trade shows myself from the inside, we got exhibits or we got the outside, I'm buying. It's such a harrowing experience going to a trade show. Beside the money, and there's lots of money involved, if you've got a booth here, you're serious, and this is like your big chance. You've been waiting to do this, and it's really important. It's really important. How do you think this year's show has gone? I mean, you've been talking to a lot of vendors. And
I've had a consistent message from all the vendors that I talk to about the booths, that the people that come to their booths are highly qualified people. They're not tire kickers that haven't seen networking technologies. They choose to go to these booths because they know they want a product that solves a problem that those networking vendors are selling, and they're going there looking for solutions.
So basically, it looks like the right people are getting to the right people.
Right, more so. That's a more consistent message than trade shows in the past. A lot of times, many people come through the door and don't know what a LAN is. But at this show, maybe it's the venue that you had to make the trip to Las Vegas. Make that investment. You can't. These people come with a purpose.
Actually, I've only seen one person, a gentleman, walked up here and said, excuse me, and said to Carl Malamud, I want to sign my business up for the internet. Where do I go? Carl was most gracious, said, read this book.
You know, Carl's written a few books.
He's written
a few.
He didn't even recommend his own book.
Oh, my.
So let's have a little round of applause for Carl, recommending his own book. That's good.
Hope he didn't recommend my book.
Nobody does.
It's very technical.
Yeah.
Again, I called it my book. Actually, what I did was I got 25 other people to write the book. People really know what's going on. I mean, my genius is I know who the real genius is.
Do you have any children, and are you really their father?
I am. Well, now, wait a minute.
Extrapolating.
I have six children, just a six-pack.
That's great. Now I want to turn to John Gage, because he's really a very interesting person in the sense that he's director of science at Sun Microsystems, but he's also been a part of this internet at showcase, and you really bridge the gap between technology and what, as you look into how do you get that information to people? How do you have people understand it? What do you make of this Interrupt conference this week?
I think one of the reasons that so many people who live on the network choose to get on an airplane and come to Las Vegas and see each other face to face is to catch up with what's turned out to be the most revolutionary thing in this world, a merger of all telecommunication, all the telephone companies, all communication, and the computing world. And what this particular merger that we've done for the last 4 days of talking and turning it into bits to go out on the internet to 30 million people or some number, uh-huh. sending pictures out on the internet, sending text. We're merging radio, television, newspaper, all into one new thing. And that's what's been most interesting for me. And I think what's drawn all the people from around the world here to Dan Lynch's friendly meeting, where everyone can go out and have dinner together and find out what's really going on, is that we've finally been able to take the telephone company's digital backbone and put it directly into all computers. So computers are becoming telephones. And telephones are becoming...
Can we get everybody confused? It's like,
very confusing.
It's the telephones, the, you know...
That's right, but it's all the same because everything's turning into... Your voice is turning into bits. The video picture of you is turning into bits. The picture that my child took yesterday and turned into bits by scanning it in is now, they're all the same and they go out on the internet. So something new is being created here, and I think that's why there's such an incredible excitement and why I predict that in Tokyo and in Atlanta there'll be more than 100,000 people. Because the person that walked up and said, how do I get my business on the internet, has figured out that something fundamental for business has happened here. What used to be the province of the rich, cost a lot of money for these computers, has now become within the reach of any child, any school, any business, and it's a way to reach other people.
Yeah.
And if you're a business, you live and die by reaching other people.
You know, that's a really good point. We talked to someone lately about doing business on the internet. She had written a book. She had to teach a class at a graduate school in Boston. And she couldn't find, she like knew businesses on the internet, but she couldn't give them a scope of how everybody used it. So she went around and she did a lot of research about how different people use it different ways. And you know, in our consciousness, we know a couple of years ago, everybody knew if you got an 800 number and a fax machine and a voicemail of some sort, you were a national business. And now, if you had an email address, you're an international business.
Right. That's right.
Right. That's simple. That's very
That's
well
real
put.
Simple. Yeah. And you're still operating out of your back bedroom.
Yeah, no one knows you're a dog on the internet, right? They can't see, they can't see behind you, right? Well, actually, they can't, but... with all this video stuff coming on, but you can buy, you know, a picture, right, to hang, and you can even morph it with some good software.
That's right. You could look any way you want.
You can look any way you want.
Which brings in some problems, of course, but we've had examples in the last 2 months, a tiny hole-in-the-wall science fiction bookstore in Palo Alto put their entire list of books up on the internet using this free software that anyone can get on PCs or Macintoshes or any workstation called Mosaic. They put up their book list. This is a store that used walk-in traffic in Palo Alto to sell a few dozen books a day. They're selling to 30 countries in 2 months.
Incredible.
Because anyone can order. You can be in Berlin and you can order American science fiction books. The entire list is there. You browse it, pick what you want. You might even be able to avoid those taxes that occur.
Now, John, I'll be careful.
But this brings, those are the sort of problems that worldwide global business brings.
Now we have a new surprise mystery guest.
It's going to be hard, yes.
Dan, why don't you introduce our new guest?
Oh, no.
Oh, this is my chance, Jack. Okay, I'll lead you. This is Jack Haverty, who is with Oracle Corporation now and was with BBN for many, many years as a developer of the ARPANET and Internet.
The group that created the
group
foundation
that created,
must.
The cause of the problem. Mm-hmm.
Well, I actually have a scary thought that came to me this morning about that, because I remember back at ISI when Dan was there and we were developing TCP, there were, 10 or 12 people that did the first implementations, and the idea was get together at ISI and everybody try to make your stuff talk to everybody else's to see if it really worked, which was, that was the first interop, Dan.
Yeah, we called them bake-offs, right?
Yeah, it was called a bake-off. But the scary thought was that I did the... PDP 11 Unix, and there was somebody with PDP 10 and Multics and so on. But universally, none of the people there that were developing the technology had any knowledge whatsoever of networking. And that's what we're all running on now. So,
you know, that's really true. That's really true. I remember when I was at NASA, we had to get all our information in over the ARPANET,
right.
You couldn't run the ILIAC, which never ran very well anyway.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But darn it, we had to get that data there and send the wrong answer back fast. And I remember designing a system software to communicate with this thing that all worked, but I mean, the idea of sitting down in your home or in your office and saying, oh, well, I want to pull this file in, so I'll sit down and write some assembly language software.
No.
It's like, We were all lucky to get anything. It didn't make any sense.
The barriers, that barrier has been a bit by bit that's going away. Now, suddenly, overnight, you don't do any, you just click. And the picture that came down from the Hubble Space Telescope 30 seconds ago is on your screen, or the picture of the comet collision with Jupiter that will happen in July that was just calculated at Jet Propulsion Lab a minute ago is in the schoolroom. It's completely new. There's no typing. There's nothing. Just
like
looking
that.
And finding.
Now, Jack, what are you doing with Oracle these days?
Well, I went to Oracle about 4 years ago, and I went through about 12 years before that of building TCP and routers and things like that. And what I discovered, and I think what Dan largely jumped on in doing interop, was that everyone was creating this technology, and nobody was delivering the instruction manual. There were all these boxes, and yeah, you could buy them all, but in terms of plugging them together, well, you're off on your own. And the real thing that was happening was there's lots of activity at that networking level, but in terms of applications and how you actually use the technology, it pretty much was the same in 1992 that it was in 1972 when there was a trade show called ICCC 72 down in the Washington Convention Center, which is where the ARPANET really rolled out public. So basically I went up the stack a bit, and I'm working on applying networking to applications technology, databases being one of the key areas that you build applications on top of, to see if we can get out of the same old applications we've had for 20 years.
Well, would you be telling any secrets if you gave us an example of an application? It's only maybe 300,000 of our closest friends are listening, and they won't tell.
They won't tell, yeah. Larry won't,
He may be listening. Never know.
Be listening, yeah.
Actually, there's two kinds of applications. The ones that, the real gap, I think, right now is if you look at the information systems people in big companies, you know, not the technical companies, but the people who make steel and oil and that kind of stuff, by and large, they're still not using this technology. They're experimenting with it, but they're not actually getting it in place. What they are using is database technology, ours as well as others, and they're absolutely desperate, eager to put them together in distributed ways. So the key application, the first one really, is just things that are built on top of databases and making it easy to understand how to actually put networks underneath those and get it to work, get it to work well. Jerry Held gave a plenary this morning, and he showed some of the more whiz-bang stuff that's going on with doing multimedia and all sorts of audio, visual, graphics, et cetera, not so much for the business side, but for the consumer side, so you can actually get information to a television set as opposed to a computer, because people understand television sets, and there's tens of billions of people out there that are potentially going to use it. So as soon as we bring that kind of application on the internet, I hope everybody's ready with lots of lines and routers and
right,
switches.
Right, yeah. My fear is that, we've woken everybody up, and there are these nice little universities that have been wonderful, websites and Gopher servers and things like that, putting up their information, and now all of a sudden they're getting hit with 100,000 requests a day and overloading them, and they're doing this gratis for free, and that's going to have to change.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's true. We put up the Lillehammer Winter Olympics.
Uh-huh.
Gosh,
and we
yes.
did it just overnight. We did it to
Boom,
tease IBM.
Oh,
yeah, IBM had all these ads that were saying they were wonderful. We found two people in Oslo that wrote something in one day that translated the Norwegian word for ice skating into English. They took the wire service feed from the Norwegian news service, pushed it through this little script, put it into these mosaic pages. They did this on Friday night. Olympics began Saturday. By Sunday, they had 120,000 hits across the global internet to get the results. By Wednesday, all lines to Norway were swamped. So we began to copy the information every 15 minutes to California and put it up so all of Japan, South America, everyone could look at it. We were getting 10,000 hits an hour. That's a quarter of a million a day. We created a new sports newspaper. This is two people, two pots of coffee, overnight, one script, that's it. Disk is free. Now, this is not a sophisticated Oracle database. This is just a lot of news story sitting there on a fob, but people want information quickly.
Well, you know, it even goes further into information expectation. My 9-year-old is a Sharks fan, and he couldn't get the hockey game.
But he knew that
the KMBR number. He knew if you called the arena, he was going. And he knew that this number that you called on the local sports line, if they change it every 3 or 4 minutes. So he calls in, and he knew he could get updated. It was like, I can get the information. I can get it. I can call here. I can call there. Can't we call up the computer? Can't we, you know? And it's like, we're not even talking about it. We all sit around and go, well, golly, look at this. We're talking about there's in their lives, there's no reason
that there should be any delay.
Any delay. Yeah. The information is here and it's mine.
I deserve it. Dan, for years,
I
mean, without the infrastructure that Dan's built, that everybody's put together for generally scientific use, now we've decided the way to really make this grow is to unleash the sports fans. So when World Cup hits, Americans don't understand the passion with which soccer is regarded in the rest of the world. Most people in San Jose didn't understand the passion that ice hockey could arise when a team started
winning.
Boy,
are they glad.
Are they glad now? They've got a winning team. Too bad Toronto. But the kids that want to get the hockey results in Argentina or in Brazil that can get them across the internet are going to go down and lobby those ministries of telecommunications to get them on the internet for hockey. Mm-hmm. Or I'm sorry, for soccer, if for nothing else.
Oh, yeah. Well, I get email requests for cassettes from Brazil from someone who's heard the program on digitized audio in Sao Paulo or someplace mm-hmm. like that while he was traveling. It's like, this is crazy, you know. Now, Jack, you had something to say there.
Yeah, I think the applications are a key thing going on here because I think that even if you look at something like Mosaic and Gopher and the web and so on, fundamentally what's really still going on is the same thing that happened in 1972 or thereabouts. It's FTP, it's remote retrieval of information. But that's very important, and it's getting more pervasive and very widespread throughout the globe. But getting applications up and running that do things that we can't even think about is really where the growth is going to occur and the explosion. And it just occurred to me that one of the things that maybe somebody who's listening could do, Las Vegas is being invaded even as we speak by people who are coming for the Kentucky Derby. So maybe there could be an internet gambling application.
Oh, could there ever? Yes, my.
So John is starting to code it up right now.
Oh, my. Let's see how we do this. All right, we'll make a deal with Oracle.
Well, that's the biggest area, sports betting. We talked about that yesterday.
I'm sure there are rules.
Dan's trying to figure out how to get a percentage.
But, well, I'll take two, okay?
Yep.
I'm sure there must be rules about it, but it's one of these things that you could do it before you would get caught.
Well, I think there's a rule to live by.
Well, it's the internet.
You can do it before you get caught.
Yeah.
But it is. It's fundamental. One of the basic challenges as this evolves, the internet knows no boundaries.
Right.
So if you go to Hong Kong and you find out that the passion of people in Hong Kong is betting at the Jockey Club, and for years the largest computer installation in all of Asia was the Jockey Club because it kept all of the betting results. Mm-hmm. And you could suddenly do betting at the Jockey Club across the internet. You could do it today from where I sit. Well, this alters all your ideas of where do national laws start and stop and where do profits start and stop, and it's a new world.
Well, you know, that's just it. The whole internet was designed so that the geographic boundaries, the geopolitical boundaries, are no longer really controlling the interest. You know, you can't tax the air unless you can kind of box it in and put a sticker on it. And the activities that can happen over it, again, are those standard things that were either controlled for power purposes or taxed. Either one will lead to misery.
Right.
Well, nobody, NPR doesn't broadcast to Brazil, yet Brazil hears you because you're digitized and you arrived in Brazil. The Dalai Lama is banned from saying anything in Beijing, but a day after the Dalai Lama spoke at the National Press Club in Washington and Carl Malamud converted his voice into bits and put it on the internet, it ended up in Beijing.
Well, I think that's it. I think what you're looking at is that it's all information, and that it goes out over national public radio. The public radio satellite hits the continental United States and U.S. territories and any United States state. It also goes out and digitizes audio to anybody, basically, who can get it on the internet. It also goes over Armed Forces Radio, which has 56 countries that it spews, and anybody can get it there. And then there's Voice of America, even NPR now, is piggybacked onto a European system. And what I'm seeing is what used to be really contained, you know, like you only saw shows on ABC, NBC, you know, and then you know, upstart Ted Turner, and data now is coming at us many different ways. We literally have to ask people, how did you hear us? You know, radio reading for the blind something that goes all over the world in all kinds of media. And it's like, how did you, well, I have a buddy and they buy it and then they send it to me and I send it to them and I'm in Sri Lanka.
Would you still get funding if we renamed you International Public Radio?
Hey, I spend any money, John. I'm really, really, my listeners. You're listening to Tech Nation Live from Las Vegas, Nevada, and the 1994 NetWorld plus Interrupt Conference. My guests today are Michael Howard, president of the Infonetics Research, Jack Haverty of Oracle, John Gage, director of science for Sun Microsystems, Carl Malamud, president of Internet Multicasting, and last but not least, Dan Lynch, founder of Interrupt. Now, do people recognize you? I recognize you.
Yeah, I know. My picture's been splattered around a bit, and so now I get that look. You know, you can hear the heads turning, you know, or something like that. And I was born in Hollywood, so I'm genetically tuned to this. It's just fine. It feels just great. And my dad was actually in the Hollywood movie business and all that. So
Hollywood Dan.
Yeah, but I left.
Okay. Now let me ask everybody, what is your hit on Information superhighway, the term? Come on, John, you start. John Gage.
No. Okay, John, you go.
Well, it always bothers me a bit because it's good that there's some term for what we're doing, and it makes it sound super, and it makes it sound high speed. That's all the implication. The bad thing about superhighways is they bypass almost everybody, and what we're really interested
in
is...
The business route.
route. Sorry, your downtown dies because the highway bypasses the town. That's not the point. Our interest is getting to absolutely everybody, and so that's what's wrong for me with all of this. And there's some notion that it's a national big buck government investment. That's not right at all. It's every individual small business school library being able to reach this enormous amount of information.
Whether the government likes it or not.
Whether the government likes it or not. And it's a form that just, we don't care, frankly, what the government thinks. They're not in control. The technology is inevitable. It's global. It passes all national boundaries. And it's becoming cheaper by a factor of 2 each year. And that's a powerful, powerful rate of advance.
Yeah. How about you, Dan?
Well, I mean, at first I thought, oh, it's neat. I remember in 1987, I was a member of a congressional subcommittee called Fix-It. FCCSET, right? And
federal.
What was the coordinating committee federal on scientific engineering technology?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, something like that.
It's a lot of meetings just getting the name, Dan.
Yeah, were you guys in that too?
Oh my.
Yeah, and we hung out in San Diego. You remember for that long week and wrote a paper and analysis of the importance of building this national
deep papers.
That's right. Okay, and we came out with honest to goodness about foot and a half. Of documents out of this group of about a couple hundred of us, right? And then that got boiled down to 2.5 pages of text in a law, okay? About 3 or 4 years later, that was the High Performance Computing and Mumble Mumble Act or something like that, which funded the NSFNet expansion and spread into high speed. And you know, back in 87, we kind of thought we needed the government to help build this thing first, you know, before the public would figure it out. Well, along the way, frankly put, Interop and NetWorld and NetWorld plus Interop just kept being out there serving the public, and by the time they got the law passed, it was like the government should just get out of the way. You know, the market was doing it, and because the government's great, except they're like anybody, and I don't blame them. You know, when they spend the money, they like to make the rules. And
the nice rules they're making now, I mean, yeah. I do think the good thing they've come to realize, the most recent legislation says, here's how it works. If you have something that links you to the network in Boston and you move to San Diego, you unplug Boston, carry your box over to San Diego, plug it in, it works. that's the way the rules are.
Yeah, that rule is a fabulous rule, okay? You have rules, you know, of interface and things like that.
It's open. Anybody can build it. You don't have any monopolies. And you have to have competition. So when you're at the house, one person doesn't get to say, we're bringing you this cable and we determine what's on it. You have cable people. You have people from, maybe it's the phone company, but since they're all really the same now, it's just bits moving across any kind of wire.
What information you want.
The people that run the electric companies have fiber that runs right past your front door. Right now, the railroad companies have fiber. That's what Sprint was based on, Southern Pacific's fiber along their railroad tracks. The water companies have fiber. The California Aqueduct has this huge bundle of fiber running down it. So there's pathways all around the world for information, and they should all be able to compete. So that we can choose. That's the point, and I think that's the direction the legislation's taken.
Uh-huh. Jack Haverty, what's your take on information superhighway?
I like to think a little kind of further ahead, I guess. I'm always accused of being up in the blue sky, but I think information superhighway as a term is really just a moniker, if you like, that people want to call what they're doing because it's too hard to explain the internet in two words or less. And what's really going on, and it's not just the internet for that matter, it's a lot more than that in the global communications, but I think what's really going on is not so much a superhighway, but we're inventing a new form of transportation. And maybe even we're inventing something different than transportation that's going to change the culture. And that's really what's going to be the interesting thing going forward. And I just thought of an example that I thought I'd bounce off Dan, that we're in this information age and we're sitting here doing a live radio broadcast over this internet superhighway thing. People were doing telecommuting, working from home, all that kind of stuff. When do you think we're going to have the first interop via network? So we actually won't have to get on airplanes and fly around, but we'll do it over the this electronic infrastructure.
Excuse me, when do you have it scheduled for?
I can
There's
see the wheels
ticket
churning.
Wow. I've never seen Dan speechless before. He's trying to figure out how to charge before he answers.
Actually, that's quite true. I mean, mumble, what am I supposed to say? Real soon now, we are working on this technology. We're with a vendor.
Is that true? Are you making this up?
I'm not making this up at all. We have.
Did you know that, Jack?
No.
We have demos of it going on in a locked room here. Right now in Vegas, we've been doing it this year. Okay, I'm serious. So, and that shouldn't be a secret because I've already told 14 people. Now I've told 140,000 or whatever. But you know, and that's part of. We want to bring this to everyone. Okay, and coming to a physical location has a whole lot of advantages, right? But if you can't do that, then let's spread the information. You know, via any technology we have. And oh, gee whiz, why don't we use the technology we're promoting? So we'll be doing that most likely next year.
Well, a great thing like this recording, I mean, ordinarily radio vanishes.
Yeah.
Gone. Well, not anymore because it's all bits on a disc someplace and you can copy it, send it anywhere. And so you're going to stay on discs more for years. This conversation is going to be on discs in Moscow and Japan and all over the world.
Hi, Mom. You better
get
all this.
You better not say silly things because Mom will call, someone will, you know, wherever you are, someone your mother knows, you know.
That's right. I mean, most people are driving along in their car and they hear radio and now they're going to think it's data, it's information. They're driving along and once it's gone, it's gone.
No more. Now it stays.
And then we made the leap to like satellites. It's like, okay, you produce it in New York, you put it on the satellite, comes wherever you happen to be. But you've got to be poised and ready. Those people are there with their tape recorders on their downlinks, and they better tape it then or air it then, or they've lost it. On the internet, it says, okay, now I'm ready for it, and you go and get it.
That's right.
It's there, and it's still there. So it's a different sense of the data and the information and what's happening. And Jack, I kind of want to return to you because I think that's one of those growth areas. At a conference like this, with as many people as we have, the big stories seem to be technology. And I mean, people just kind of smirk at the information superhighway, which actually Paul Saffo, I think, described as the most moronic term he had ever heard. But it's like, they keep saying, what's the biggest thing? And they keep naming technology. When you're talking about applications, over the technology, the people who are really going to fly into that area and actually use it are not going to want to know a lot about the technology.
Exactly.
And so
They want to see a fast forward, a stop. They want to see the familiar control buttons,
on,
right?
On, off. Right. They don't probably don't even want to touch it. They just want to make sure it's there. Right. So the whole idea of information is changing. And tell us a little about that, Jack.
Yeah, I think it's just a continuation of the evolution. If you, some of us have been around long enough to remember doing things with assembly language programming and laying out disk sectors and all that kind of stuff. And you actually had to do that to write an application, and now you don't anymore. So all the computers come with file systems, they come with programming environments, and there's lots of interesting technology there. But it's going forward so that it's more and more a case that you can now build an application. Whoever has an idea can build an application literally in a garage. It's not just creating a radio program or a business that sells some kind of product, but even software is that way now as well, up at the applications level where it hits a cultural thing. So Mosaic came out of a research lab and various other things. What happens in the future, I don't think we'll know. I think we're on the edge of a kind of a revolution similar to what happened when PCs came into being, where now all sorts of people from all walks of life could start using computers and doing weird and wonderful things with them. What we're going to see in the networking environment in that analogous way is...
It's going to evolve, yeah. When the PCs first came out, everybody said there's going to be a computer in your kitchen, and it's like, it still isn't in my kitchen.
It probably is, but it's in your refrigerator.
Yeah, it's in your refrigerator.
It's everywhere. It's in my microwave.
Okay, in your blender.
In my blender, but it's not the laptop on the counter, you know, so that some of those early predictions don't turn out to be true.
Well, I think they didn't realize PCs were never built to be networked. And the notion that there's something out there that's useful, that the network brings that. And so now a PC with a lot of work and retrofit is a perfectly decent something to be on the network. And you'll find it's useful because if you're watching that program teaching you how to do that, cook that something, and all the information about it appears in your, call it a PC or your smart stove or, I don't know, your smart refrigerator, it's useful. And if it's useful, you'll pay for it. And the connections are now coming. We're getting them. So I think I like this idea Jack had about a new form of transportation. You know, something new is here. I have a really very, this is my summary of how all these things, here's my laws of six here.
John's laws of six.
I was playing with this. And so when speech began 60,000 years ago. It's not a long time, but 60,000 years of speech.
Right. Are you there?
I heard about
this. He's been around.
6,000 years ago, writing started. Well, it changed everything because now you could actually have a permanent record of something. Otherwise, you had to repeat stories by memorizing what somebody else said. So everything, the ways you remembered things changed. 600 years, well, more or less, mass printing happened, which made writing cheap. No more monks copying. Now you've got everybody able to read stuff, and that altered. But all these same forms still continue side by side. We still have poetry and oral tradition. We still have elegantly written things, but now we have mass market books and cheap stuff. Then we add 60 years ago TV. Suddenly got pictures moving all over the place and the telephone links everybody up. And the next evolution was 6 years ago, which was MTV, which who knows what this is. This is a mixture, different visuals, different speed of doing things. And now we have this something across this worldwide network that blends all of these things together. And the people that will create new and interesting, the creative people, the content is what the usual jargon is around here. The content providers, you, the New York Times, the Peter Gabriels, the artists, this is now becoming something they're going to use, and they're going to turn it into something none of us imagined.
Yeah, right. I remember a few months ago I ran into the guy that did Mosaic, Mark Anderson, and I was shocked when I met him. I said, oh, this Mosaic stuff is neat. It's wonderful. Obviously, okay, it's one heck of a great step forward from what old people like Jack and I, you know, and John put together years ago. And I used to be a member of the Internet Architecture Board that we basically defined the rules of the road for developing all this technology. And at one of the last meetings I was at when I was on it a few years ago, we talked about this Mosaic stuff. It was just starting to come out of the University of Illinois. And we kind of looked around the room like, who authorized that? And then, you know, we realized, whoa, wait a minute, nobody authorized it. that no one has to, oh, gee whiz, it's out, you know.
It's out of our control.
It's out of our control. I mean, you know, we've built a few simple things, and enough people are doing with it things we did not imagine. And then when I ran into Mark a few weeks ago, okay, for the first time, I told him that, you know, that, gee whiz.
He's,
you know,
unauthorized.
He's unauthorized, okay. The parents, you know, couldn't stop him, and he would, and that we were proud of him. And I really said that to him, you know, because he's about 25 years old, you know, and bright, and he was just pleased as punch, you know, because he actually kind of felt like he was sneaking around, you know, and he was kind of sneaking around. And now I think the word is out. You don't have to sneak around. Okay, the internet is yours. It belongs to all of us. Okay?
This is,
and do what you want.
And you listen to all this hype about the giant industries and the computing business, and oh, Microsoft is this massive thing. It's about 12,000 people or something sitting in Washington. And they make a couple of billion dollars. I mean, we make a lot more than that. But they're out there. But they have a lock on these sort of old PC environments. And one kid, Mark Andreessen, writes this code, 9,000 lines of code, and it turns every screen in the world into Time Magazine or Business Week. It's all pictures and graphics, and it's free. And it's out there in millions of copies overnight. I mean, this has been 6 months, 8 months, I don't know. I guess he puts his first version out at the beginning of last, you know, maybe June was the first time last year. So we've been a 9-month phenomenon, and the network traffic, Jack, it's gross.
Yeah, well, he's melting the net, and I think that's what Jack wants to jump in on here.
No, I have to jump in here because this is one of the things that I really see. When you're trying to take a technology from a research kind of environment into a real production environment, economics come in, and it's really not free. Somebody's paying for it, right?
Yes.
And it may work fine if there's a few people.
We do have to grow up. I hate that part.
Oh,
yeah.
Darn.
But, you know, what happens when 2 million people start running Mosaic 7 hours a day?
As they are.
Work or not. Well, no, they're not.
Dan got so excited he drank my water.
That was water?
That's right. That's where you got mine. That's right.
I think there's an important thing going on underneath there, that the people who build technology, you can try out new things, and when you're trying them out for concepts and ideas, it's really great. For it to actually become successful, it has to obey whatever the economic laws are.
Yeah.
So it has to be something.
$8 a month, okay, or $5
whatever.
a movie or a hit, an entertainment hit, right?
Yeah. You know? And that's really the key to hitting the real growth.
Well, we know we're past email now. We know we're past sending text files around. We know we got voice. We know we got video. What else do we got we want to send around?
We want to spend money, digital money.
Mm-hmm.
And the foundation technology here is encryption.
Yes.
Yeah, this is absolutely fundamental. How can we do an interop and let not just 100,000 people in Las Vegas participate, but let several hundred thousand people worldwide listen to all the talks, which after all costs a lot
audio.
Of money to put on.
Okay.
It's audio, but it has behind it a charging mechanism. So we need digital money. Citicorp needs it.
There is a worldwide transfer of funds mechanism. You're talking about something else. What
or
are you
the
talking
people.
About? Oh, this is a bartering, kind of internet barter coins,
well,
kind of script?
Yeah, ARPA bucks is what we called them, right? 20 bucks, 20 years ago.
ARPA bucks.
Okay. We need a mechanism so when you want to spend something at some place, or you want to tell your bank to send money to somebody, you can do it in total security. You know, nobody can pretend to be you. You can be authenticated. They can say, oh, yes, it's really Moira. I, the bank, will send money there. And the technology to do this is just beginning to evolve. And when that volume of data hits the net, that's going to melt it, really melt it. Because, and by melt it, I mean that all those people that today think a little bit of data is going through these wires are going to find it in retail transactions,
now we get,
real business.
I'm actually going down a path here that I want to kind of figure out. What we're saying, what I'm trying to say is, how big is it so we understand how fast what we have is going to melt and how big it has to be. But we're talking... we're certainly talking email, we're talking text files sending around, just in general, you know, that we're working with. We're talking audio, we're talking video, and we're talking transactions.
Transactions.
Is what you're talking about. And it's not just that, it's transactions. So we're talking not just the, you know, whenever you talk data transfer, you have to talk volume and time frame. You know, what's the window it has to appear in? And so are there any other things we're going to be sending around on the net that we now kind of sense or know about?
Well, take some simple ones. Right now in the United States, one phone call in four the estimate is a fax call, which means it's sending bits. It's an image of a piece of paper.
Okay,
this is a stunning shift in just the last 2 or 3 years.
So that's a subset of the video.
No. Yeah, it's
one frame of the video.
It's graphics.
It's graphics.
It's okay, some kind of image. We all, since it's all just bits, but suddenly there's a huge volume of stuff.
I know, but we're still talking like what it is. Then we'll talk about how big it is.
Well, okay.
All right. Faxes are another in there. It's either one frame of video or it's a specialized form of email or something.
Another is sensing data. Right now, if I'm close to a heart attack, it's trivial to measure the electric pattern of my heart. Trivial. Anybody can look at that pattern and say,
oh,
stop drinking coffee, John, would be a useful thing for somebody to say. That kind of data, the medical data, the health data that you can buy in any pharmacy today, cheap, you know, measured blood level, sugar in your blood, and all. You go spend $50, you get a little device that does this. Those kinds of monitoring devices for health add an enormous volume of data. We have transaction data like retail and bank and financial. Environmental monitoring information. How hot is this room? Well, the thermostat knows that, but it doesn't know it
so
all
around.
So
there's some raw data collection that gets passed
huge
around.
Huge amounts in every room and every structure and every building is going to be acquiring data.
But the thing is it going to get moved around and who's going to do it? Jack, you had something to say here.
Yeah, I think there are two whole categories of things that are going to move around that we've barely scratched the surface of. And one of those really keys off the applications notion that everybody now has or will have computing power all over the place, in your PDA, on your desktop, whatever. And what we've been talking about really is everything is viewing information in some form, whether it's video or audio, and that's one large category of things that move across networks. The other thing that's going to happen, though, is and we see it in our world with things like distributed databases, but what's going to move around is data. And it's going to move from one computer to another because you want to do some processing on it and that computer over there is the right place to do it. It's all data. But it's really computers talking to computers to move that data to the place that for whatever reason it needs to be worked on. And nobody can really guess at the amount of data that's going to involve because it could be enormous.
But who's going to provide it?
Well, it'll be part of the applications. The applications will be restructured so that instead of just viewing information that's coming through the net and onto some form of screen or speaker, it now comes to a computer, which probably has a screen or speaker behind it as well. So it's the same information, the same data, but it's being handled in a different way. Computer programs talking to computer programs right. Instead of the visual part. Closely coupled with that is the fact that computer programs themselves are just data. And they can move around. So you get the notion of intelligent agents, things that can go wandering around the net doing things, maybe carrying their data along with them like little baggage.
That's right.
And that's really scratched the surface.
Well,
the Internet Worm was a great example
of this. There's a simple new kind of data that's going to alter a lot because of these satellites up in the flying around the Earth that let you, with a tiny handheld device, measure where you are.
Global positioning system.
I suddenly know I could put a card on Dan's shirt pocket, and then I would know latitude, longitude, and altitude.
Can you see his the person who escorted him here, Lisa Morgan? She is writing this down now because she can never keep track of where he is.
This will keep track of him. It's trivial because now...
Now only within 100 meters.
I can get General Horn to say we track the soldier in the field and Dan Lynch.
The military attempted to make this data... The military attempted to make this global positioning data inaccurate so you couldn't put a cruise missile down my chimney or something. But easy to fix.
A simple
engineer just said, oh, you know, I know where I am.
Get three of them, you can triangulate.
And so now you can be accurate to about a foot or two. And with that means if you're moving trucks or cars or any vehicle or any package, you can know where it is.
Yeah, right.
And suddenly everything that changes about how a city... Yes, suddenly...
Well, that's just it. What I'm sitting there saying is that I see an explosion in the applications, in the area that Jack's working in here. And if I've got five applications lined up here and five big organizations that want to go, and I have a little bit of pipe to go down... People who own pipes or are ready to move things, whether it's compressing it over some standard stuff, or if you're ready to move the data, you'll be able to cash the check. You know?
Right.
And that's my real question. And I think I wasn't clear when I asked you, it's like, who's going to make those pipes? Are they there already? Who's moving ahead on that?
Well, I know who's going to be. Here's an application that I think will happen in 10 years or less that may frighten you.
I love this. This is great radio.
Oh, cool. Okay. No, it's in your automobile, you probably have anywhere from 5 to 25 computers right now that sort of do various, perform various system functions. I mean, when you step on the accelerator, that's a request to a computer to
yeah, be clear.
To to operate some valves, right?
Please
and
work.
Some gas and air in, right? And it's no longer a direct mechanical linkage at all. And I'm not sure how brakes are, if they're in that kind of loop right now.
Mm-hmm. ABS.
But ABS is absolutely, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. I've used that. Yeah, you slam on the brakes and your car stops cleanly, okay? Yeah, wonderful.
Unless it disregards you when you're being
irresponsible. Disregards you and all that sort of jazz, right, okay. Well, so, and these, when you go bring your car in for fixing now, they drive it up to a computer tester device, right, and there's a little local area net running around underneath your car now, because it's more efficient to just have one hookup point, and then it pulls everything. So there's a little kind of Ethernet running around your car, and so all these little computers are actually, individual computers. They have internet IP addresses, as we call them. They're addressable points. And all, I can see it now, and about someday my car will have a little antenna on it of some kind, okay? And this information that's on board can be,
you can stay home.
I can stay home. No, it can be sensed anywhere.
And send it up.
No, and then maybe someday there'll be a little bit of software that lets my car talk to your car,
That is scary.
Okay.
That's the scary part you're talking about?
Yeah, and slam on your brakes or get out of my way, turn you off to the side. I mean, there's, I'm serious. Traffic control, congestion control would work much better if the cars would get into synchrony and if these things all got hooked up into some giant...
And that jerk in front of me.
Yeah, that jerk in front of you.
Yes, Gallagher always wanted to put
And you say, I want, the Bob ad, you want to go down a highway real fast? If you're willing to transmit digital money to all the cars in front of you to move over, and
right.
then you get to go down. I mean, there's all kinds of applications.
Park your Rambler in the left lane and collect.
Yeah, you're willing to turn up the meter for the road rights? I mean, it's...
But see, that's just it. It may be. I'll tell you what where Jack got me thinking here, because I really think what he's saying is right. And it may be that at the time you're developing the application, you should develop the application and send it out over the net. And the worst thing, you might find a better path because of how much you need it or who's got the data storage on the
right.
other end. But it may be if you're going to be the successful applications developer, you're also going to have to find a pipe for it. And inside your little car, you have your little local area network, and it may be the Department of Transportation. It's actually going to stop trying to tax a bunch of things, but it could tax these little transmissions that said, "I'll give you a dime if you get me in the left lane." And that's all wireless communication, and that's not physical. When you get wireless communication, if you can get it cohesive enough, you can fill the air. Really nicely, so it changes the whole look.
Oh, we'll microwave ourselves with left turn signals, right, or something.
Yeah.
Vanity plates take on a whole new dimension.
Yeah.
Vanity modem.
Everybody gets to change your plate.
Yeah, right.
There's an idiot in front of me or something, and you're able to add your opinions. And after a while, as your license plate turns red from embarrassment from the number of people that have sent a packet at you about this, please learn to drive.
My guests have been Dan Lynch, founder of the Interop Conference, Carl Malamud, president of the Internet Multicasting Service, John Gage, chief scientist of Sun Microsystems, Jack Haverty of Oracle Corporation, and Michael Howard, president of Infinetics Research. I spoke with them at the 1994 NetWorld plus Interop Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. Special thanks to Internet Multicasting Service and the Internet Showcase in providing facilities for this program. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.